This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a joint GHIL lecture in cooperation with the Modern German History Seminar at the Institute of Historical Research, given by Nina Verheyen, currently a guest professor at the Free University of Berlin, on global connections and personal achievements, de-centering the self in Fantasiejägler Germany. Within a few decades, people in Imperial Germany witnessed a dramatic rise in global exchange, as well as an increased public interest in personal achievement. Work performance, intelligence, sporting achievements, and so on were measured, standardized, optimized, and above all, cherished. This lecture scrutinizes the link between both of these trends. It highlights two aspects. On the one hand, global exchange allowed and helped certain people in Germany to achieve new and sometimes outstanding things. But on the other, the idea of a purely personal achievement made the global factors behind such achievements invisible. In other words, the fin de siècle cult of personal achievement relied on global interactions and at the same time concealed them.
Thank you very much for the kind invitation and for the kind introduction. So I'm very pleased to be able to speak to you here today. Again, I must say about the topic of my last book that dealt with achievement orientation and performance orientation, starting out in Germany around 1900, and then from there kind of looking both into different direction in terms of time, so going back to the late 18th century as well as forth to the late 20th century, and also going to other countries. As it was already mentioned, the book was published in 2018. And after that, I kept working on the manuscript and I handed in an extended manuscript as a Habilitationsschrift at the University of Cologne. And I'm now, that was about 2 years ago, I think. And by now I'm a Privatdozent at the University of Cologne, very prestigious title. And I'm now about to transforming that Habilitationsschrift manuscript into yet another book manuscript that is supposed to come out in English. So I'm saying this so that you know that I'm still able, that I'm actually still working on the book, although it's kind of painful for me to hear that it's 10 years ago or even more that I spoke about that project already. But back then I was really very much in the beginning. I was actually that was actually before I really started with that project. So what I want to say is that I'm still able to take into account your advice, if you have any, although of course I do not can do new research. But I also want to say in advance that I think that the research about achieving society's achievement orientation in Germany and Europe around 1900, to my mind, is still a very attractive field that even though a lot of studies have already been written, I think will attract even more attention in the next years. And so I also hope a little bit to give perhaps some advice on how other people might go on with research in this field. It was in 1903 that the Berlin intellectual Georg Simmel published a narrow but extremely dense essay on competition as a mode of social behavior in the German cultural journal Neue Deutsche Rundschau. In it, Simmel described competition as a special form of struggle or even fighting, in which people did not hurt each other, but tried to outdo each other with their own performance. In this fight, Simmel said, the fight consists only in the fact that each of the contenders strives towards the goal without using force on the opponent. The runner who wants to work only by his beak, the merchant who wants to work only by the price of his goods, the proselyte maker, I hope I pronounce it correctly, and I apologize for my English, who wants to work only by the inner persuasiveness of his doctrine, exemplify the strange kind of struggle, which is equal to any other in fierceness and passionate exertion of all forces. It's increased to this utmost performance only by the interacting consciousness of the performance of the opponent, to the struggle against the machine, which tests performance, to the struggle of man against himself, and yet outwardly seen, proceeds as if there were no opponent, but only the goal in the world. End of quote. On the right-hand side, you can now see a small photograph of Georg Simmel. I will go into Simmel and Simmel's sociology in more detail in the first part of my remarks today, in order to clarify the overarching concern of my study from there. Following in Simmel's footsteps, I'm concerned with the historical anthropology of the category of personal achievement, starting from the dual question of what personal achievement meant as a category of the social and what it meant to people culturally, why it was significant to them. Georg Simmel is well suited as a starting point for this, I think, and as the quotation just given already shows. For in the sociology of competition, Simmel describes competition not only as a peculiar struggle, but also as a highly performance-oriented endeavor. Following Simmel, competitions help to increase performance and they allow to hierarchize people along their performance. From this approach to achievement or performance orientation, in German Leistungsorientierung, a term difficult to translate into English, in the sociology of Georg Simmel in part one, I jump in part two to global connections. My habilitation thesis, by the way, is by no means primarily about global interconnections, and I am not a global historian. However, my book does include global connections, and it does so, among other things, because Simmel's world was a highly globally connected one, whether you take it to mean the planet around 1900, Germany, or Berlin. Berlin, you see it in the other illustration, was just like London or Paris at the time, not only involved in global interactions, it was also in part shaped by global interactions. Anyone, I think, who deals with the German Empire or with the Berlin scholar around 1900 should therefore take global connections into account. I will clarify this in the second section of my remarks. And finally, then, I will devote myself to the connection between the two sections, i.e. the notion of achievement and performance orientation described by Simmel in Fernsehjagd Germany or in Simmel's world, certainly a very fluid place, and global interactions of that time. As I would like to show, meritocratic modernity, or more precisely, modernity that claims to be organized meritocratically, is one that distracts from global interdependencies, although, and perhaps precisely because, it needs them so much, owes so much to them. So, achievement orientation in Simmel's sociology. Many of you, of course, will know Georg Simmel, so I don't really need to introduce him here. But since rightfully, I think not everyone perhaps is interested in the great man of German sociology and cultural philosophy, let me at least briefly mention that Georg Simmel is regularly counted among this group and thus positioned in a row with people such as Max Weber, Ferdinand Tönnies, Werner Sombart, and a few more. Born in 1858 to a family of Berlin merchants, Simmel, at least as much a cultural philosopher as a sociologist, spent most of his life in Berlin, where he worked for a long time as a Privatdozent at Berlin University before becoming a professor at the University of Strasbourg in 1914. In the group of prominent people just mentioned, he played a special role in that he was particularly prominent already at that time. In fact, he was actually a little star in Berlin. His lectures were regarded as events to which the Berlin liberal educated society made pilgrimages, both men and women. Max Weber may therefore have had him in mind when he described in a famous speech the army of Privatdozenten at German universities who produced extremely significant academic achievements without receiving a professorship in return. The fact that this lasted so long in Simmel's case was very probably also related to the anti-Semitism of German academia, which considerably distrusted the son of converted Jews. In any case, it was certainly not due to a lack of personal achievement. But what was personal achievement? In German, Leistung, which can also be translated as performance, according to Simmel. The category plays a central role in the work of all of the people mentioned so far, Weber, Tönnies, Sombart, and Simmel. And by each of them, it is understood differently. In German language sociology of later times, for example, if you look at the text by Klaus Offe from the 1970s and 1980s, almost recently into the books by Sigurd Neckel, as well as in French and Anglo-American sociology at the turn of the century, there are further definitions. All in all, this results in a broad panorama of understandings of achievement / performance / in German, Leistung. Even if one restricts oneself exclusively to the discipline of sociology. If one goes beyond sociology and looks into disciplines like economics, physics, psychology, law, one finds even many more definitions. Therefore, when I briefly explain in the following how Simmel approached this category, they should by no means be misunderstood as representative, neither for discourses at the turn of the century, nor for discourses within the discipline of sociology throughout the 19th and 20th century. To start with, the category of performance / achievement / Leistung, and the following, I will use the three terms as interchangeable, was central to Simmel's oeuvre. Although he did not write a single essay specifically devoted to the category of achievement, the word ran like a thread through various of his writings. For example, his Soziologie des Geldes, Sociology of Money, and his Soziologie der Konkurrenz, Sociology of Competition. I would like to argue that in these two writings in particular, Leistung not only functioned as a word, but it was actually shaped into a category of the social. Following Simmel, it was key in a modern social order that did not tie personal status to the group to which a person belonged, defined by origin, religion, religious affiliation, etc., and fixed by birth. Instead, it tied status to what a person did personally, what he or she attempted, created, and reached based on his or her very own abilities and efforts. In order to more fully understand performance as a social category in the Simmelian sense, I'm wondering if you can say that. Can you? Well, in Simmel's sense, three aspects are central. Firstly, Simmel's category of achievement oscillates in a very interesting and peculiar way between the personal and the collective. For Simmel, an achievement is a value that is created by an individual only, but it is being created for others as well as in front of others, and to a certain extent also with others. These others appear in multiple roles. They define the standard to evaluate an achievement in the abstract. They also function as jurors to make the concrete evaluation. And they are the recipients, the buyers of a performance. Those who confirm that it actually is valuable. And those who turn it into a valuable good. Apart from that, as the quote at the beginning showed, the others are also important because people compete with them. And observing what others do, people learn, strive, and get better. So in sum, Simmel thought of performance as a relational category, symptomatic of him as an early representative of a relational sociology, and as a decisive element of the relational structure in which, following Simmel, the modern individual was included, and even more, by which it was made. For Simmel, achievements were socially constructed and they were objective values at the same time. This tension is the second aspect that I would like to highlight. If I say objective, that should not be understood in the sense of objective as opposed to subjective, but in the sense of an actual higher value, following Simmel, hopefully recognized as such by a community, and also defined by a community that considered something to be valuable. From there, Simmel linked achievement to achievement orientation. He assumed that different people share their belief in the existence of personal performance, as well as in the value of personal performance as such. And he assumed that at least all men, women were to a certain extent excluded, would constantly strive to improve their performance. The merchant, according to Simmel, the runner, and so on, they all strive to outdo the other with their performance. But not to primarily eliminate an opponent, so to speak, negatively motivated, but positively motivated in the intrinsically motivated striving for maximum performance as a value in itself. Seen in this light, Simmel's sociology is not only a sociology of performance, but above all, a sociology of performance orientation. In addition to contouring Leistung as a relational category and at the same time as an objective value, there's another, a third characteristic that is central to Simmel's understanding of performance, namely commensurability. Posimal performance is something that can be compared, even measured, on a fixed scale. Therefore, in terms of content, this category is highly plastic, but it is always about something of which a person can produce more or less. It allows, therefore, to hierarchize people. Performance is a category that invites people to compete with each other and to outperform others in the competition. And it is a category that always holds the risk of a painful experience, namely to perform less than others, to perform not enough, to fall short of others in performance. Taken together, performance in Simmel's view is a category of the social that is firstly relational in nature. It interweaves the abilities of the individual with the needs of others. Secondly, it has an objective quality insofar as it indicates an actual value, or at least a value that people believe in as an objective value, which is why they orient themselves to this value, which, following Simmel, is a good thing. In this respect, his sociology of achievement is decisively a sociology of achievement orientation, and it is also a plea for achievement orientation. The third characteristic is that personal achievement or performance or Leistung is in principle commensurable and even measurable. Performances can be compared, arranged, or hierarchized along their size. They're thus also allowed to hierarchize people along their very own performance, or rather along what people think of as their very own personal performance. Those who perform well are at the top, those who perform poorly are at the bottom, and those who perform moderately are in the middle. Against this background, I would like to add that according to Simmel, personal performance was not a static quantity. It had to be constantly recreated, proven anew, performed anew. That is also why the world following Simmel was a very dynamic one, in which people constantly competed with each other, which following Simmel was a very good thing, because it linked people to each other as they performed for others, together with others and in front of others. And it also helped them to perform even more and even more. In my research, I do not primarily judge this interpretation of achievement, although I would like to point out that I think it is a proper sociology of achievement orientation, and therefore I think it is highly interesting. But I do not primarily judge it, rather I try to understand it, and I try to historize it, because I think that it is very important that this idea of an achieving society was described in Fantasy Germany, that is in Germany around 1900. I think there is a link between how the Simmel perceived the world to be and what actually happened at that time in Berlin, in Germany, and abroad, because as I want to show in the next chapter, it would be very problematic to reduce the perspective to Germany only. The world that Simmel saw and the world that Simmel tried to make sense of was a world that was, at least in parts, globally connected, although I know that that term is very problematic. Germany around 1900 was, of course, already a nation state, as you all know, but it was not a national container within which things took place independently of the outside world. On the contrary, as recent literature on global connections has sufficiently shown, the German Empire was intensively globally entangled. Furthermore, it was not simply involved in global interactions, but more sharply, it was also to a considerable extent made through global interactions. At least one could say so. Maybe we can discuss this later. Therefore, and at least I think so, before I return to the theory of performance orientation, the third part of my remarks, I would like to conclude this global aspect of German society around 1900. So part two, global connections in an entangled world. History as an academic discipline has changed a lot in the last decades, at least in Germany, due to the economic crisis of the university, due to the crisis of science in the post-factual age, but also due to new insights into the connectedness of the world, not as a new phenomenon, but as a phenomenon with a long history. 3 or 4 decades ago, it was taken for granted in German history departments to focus primarily on Germany and best at European history. Today, the world historians at German history departments deal with is much bigger. History departments make great effort in order to recognize the historicity of the so-called non-Western world, a very problematic term, of course, and to research and teach a history that goes way beyond Germany, Europe, and the West. At the same time, this tendency is by no means simply a matter of expanding the subject of history spatially. It is much more fundamentally a matter of rethinking our notion of history and of the discipline of history itself. And it is a matter of rethinking what we used to call German history. Now, whether you want to call the shift a global shift or whether you find the phrase to be too vague or even misleading, the described shift has crystallized in an outstanding rise of global history within German academia. For more than two decades now, historians from that field, which I do not consider myself a part of, I'm rather a bystander and a latecomer and someone who learns from that field. So for more than two decades now, historians from that field have been campaigning to take global interconnections seriously and to treat them not only as an object, but broader as a starting point, frame, and perspective of historical analysis. In doing so, global history draws on very different lines of tradition, including post-colonial studies. In this respect, global history in its latest version is certainly also motivated by political ideas. However, it is not a political movement, as I want to stress, but above all, an academic project. The central argument is that history can be better understood, better explained, and better described if it is freed from a national or world regional container. There are now numerous studies that provide impressive empirical evidence of this, I think. Among the more recent of the prominent studies in this field is Sven Beckert's highly acclaimed study of the history of capitalism. Beckert presents a global history of capitalism that not only integrates many different world regions, but that also succeeds in overcoming a firmly established Eurocentric narrative. Older scholarship always considered capitalism to be something that was mainly generated in the West, most significantly also in Britain, and then unfolded from there across the world. Beckert, on the other hand, argues that modern capitalism emerged in the cotton plantations of European colonial powers, that is, in the global south of an entangled world, and that this birth was linked to colonial violence and slavery. From there, in an arena of interaction between the British and the global south, capitalism conquered the world and not least changed Europe. Not only because I'm speaking here in the UK today, I would like to point out that global history in the form practiced by Beckert and in the form it flourished, or it has flourished in Germany, so remarkably in the last decades, has received central impulses from the new imperial history. New imperial history, as many of you will know better than me, is a label for a very heterogeneous Anglo-Saxon school of historical scholarship that has overcome traditions of older empire studies, especially on the British Empire. I find it helpful to point out the connection between global history and new imperial history because it makes clear that the global turn cannot be reduced to the simple formula of discovering global connections. Instead of a discovery of global connections, it is rather about a reinterpretation of global connections. The example of new imperial history illustrates this particularly well. According to conventional empire studies, the metropole was at the center of an empire that was ruled, controlled, shaped, and even improved from Great Britain and by Britons. Studies from the field of new imperial history, instead of that, describe firstly the ambivalences of the imperial project, the combination, for example, of civilization and oppression, of science and violence. Secondly, they describe the limits of the imperial project. What happened in the colonies was not only decided by the British, but also by the people on the ground who exercised, who had a lot of agency. And thirdly, it describes the influences that imperial activities had on the metropole itself, whether consumption or family life, ideas of gender or class, they were, at least in parts, shaped through the colonial encounter and through colonial entanglements. Now, can this perspective on British history be applied to the history of neighboring European countries? To what extent does what goes for Great Britain also go for nations like France, Portugal, or the Netherlands with a long colonial tradition? And to what extent does it also go for states like Germany, Italy, or Belgium, which only acquired their colonies in the late 19th century? Well, this has been the subject of controversial debate for many years now. And I myself was for a very long time quite skeptical, to be honest. But I've changed during the last, five to 10 years, my perspective, because I think that the new research in the field of globally has really given a lot of empirical evidence for the importance and for the reality of global connections. And also because in my own sources, I have then noticed that global connections were actually key in order to understand what I was looking at. For example, when I started back then, 10 years ago, I already worked with Georg Simmel, but I always thought of him as a sociology that dealt to a certain extent, of course, with modern society, but also with German society. If you look at Simmel more closely, you realize he is talking about the world. He uses the term very often, and he does not confine his perspective to the German nation state only. He does not explicitly say that he talks about a globally connected world, but his world is fluid. The borders are fluid. And I think it is very helpful to kind of follow on that track when you want to understand why achievement orientation was important to many Germans around 1900 and what that meant. So I think that, as I said, I've kind of changed my own perspective, which is why I am a newcomer and latecomer in this field. I'm someone who learns from others. And for a long time, I thought that it was rather, let's say a fashion that all too many people already followed. So I thought I did not have to do that too. But I've changed my mind due to the evidence that has been produced in this field. So today, I think that insight into global connections can really help us to see European and also German history in a new way, and that these studies remind us to no longer treat history as something that took place in a container, in a national container, but as something that was constantly shaped by the seemingly outside. For the German Empire, that is also true. And I point this out because my impression is that in German academia at the moment, although on the one hand, global history has is well established, it is in fact extremely well established by now. At the same time, I think there's still a kind of gap between historians who now engage in the field of global history, which has very much become its own field with its own journals and so on and so on, and the historians of German history who do not interact with that field. I think it would be very important for us to kind of bridge these two fields and to not think of them as different fields, but as highly intertwined. And that's what I'm kind of trying to do with my research, to bring these two fields together, standing kind of in the middle. The German Empire emerged at a time that experienced a first peak of global interactions. And with global interactions, I mean trans-regional interactions. So interactions that not only went across national borders, but that kind of connected the European world with other world regions. And in fact, not only with one other world regions, but with at least a couple of, let's say, world regions. So that's what I mean when I talk about global connections, global interactions. Of course, it does not mean that the world in total is part of that. In fact, global history has stressed again and again that it should not be misunderstood as world history. While world history, the old world history, kind of tried to talk about the globe in total, global history talks about connections across the globe. So connections between parts in the world that at first glance have nothing to do with each other. So the German Empire emerged at a time that experienced the first peak of global interactions. International trade, international transport, international migration and communication increased significantly in the course of the 19th century and reached a dramatic increase in the decades before the First World War. Germany was intensively involved in these connections that shaped politics, social structures, and also everyday life. The empire was modern, as Jens Jäger convincingly argues, also because it was globally connected. Furthermore, Germany was also an empire by now, and Germany had colonies on a considerably spatial scale before the First World War. And it was shaped by colonial entanglements too. For example, the colonial experience shaped and changed the laws for citizenship, for marriage. It changed the way protective vaccinations were dealt with and the way racial violence was thought of, to pick just a few examples. Now, apart from the details, the important point here is that global history does not simply add another topic to the history of the German Empire, namely global connections. Rather, it adds a new explanatory approach to the history of the German Empire that can be made fruitful with regard to very different topics, even where global connections do not appear to be significant at first glance. At least that is the plea, let's say, the idea, the assumption. Therefore, when I now, in the last section of my talk, return to Georg Simmel's sociology of performance and to performance orientation, I would like to link this performance orientation to global connections. So section 3, decentering achievement orientation in Fernsehclub Germany. Let me point out that the history of performance orientation in Fernsehclub Germany is very well researched. It is not possible to give an overview because so much research has actually been done. It is especially worth, however, to recall Anson Rabenbach's relevant study on the human motor and thus on discourses about human labor power that intensified during the last decades of the 19th century. And to recall Sebastian Konrad's study on nation and globalization in Imperial Germany. With this book, Konrad gives empirical evidence for his theoretical call for the integration of global and colonial entanglements into German history. He analyzes contemporary discourses on national labor, as well as practices of labor, shaped by global migration and also by colonial violence. The monographs by Rabenbach and Konrad are only two studies in an infinitely broad field of studies that becomes all the broader the more one is prepared to understand Leistung, not only as a synonym for work performance, as is often done, and as the two studies just mentioned also do it, but more broadly. In fact, such a broadening of scope makes a lot of sense since in the German language, as it was spoken around 1900, the term Leistung referred to much more than just work performance. It referred, for example, also to education and to intelligence. And depending on the context, it also referred to duty, virtue, and demand, and many other things. One of the aims of my project is to recall the broad sense that the term Leistung had in Germany around 1900, and to analyze Leistung as a scope of interactions in that broader sense. To treat Leistung as a synonym of work or work performance only is, in fact, quite ahistorical. Simmel understood Leistung more broadly, too. Although he repeatedly cited examples from the field of work to describe performance competitions, these went beyond the field of work. In essence, for Simmel, achievement was a value created through ability and effort. This could be an academic achievement as well as a work of art, but also a convincing performance as a lover. Thus, Simmel's understanding of performance clearly went beyond the discourse of work performance and the practices of work that both Rabenbach and Konrad describe. Achievement was much more, which is also why it seems so valuable to many. If one tries to understand both the social and the subjective meaning of the category of achievement, it is therefore essential, in my view, to approach the subject more broadly as well. Therefore, I do not limit myself to workforce, and I do not limit myself to a single practice field, let's say the workplace. Rather, in my research, I try to interweave different areas, work with education, for example, but also education with leisure, with sports, and many other arenas of practices in everyday life. Simmel's sociology of Leistung did not emerge in a vacuum. The sociologist observed, I think, described, analyzed social cultural tendencies, everyday phenomena and everyday trends. If done carefully, I think he can be used as a key to everyday phenomena. Although, of course, this does not mean that simply because Simmel's sociology centered around achievement, the world in which he lived centered around achievement too. However, there are a couple of, let's say, connections. To start with, in Germany at the turn of the century, Simmel's interest in personal achievement was not an isolated case, and it did not only stand for a certain social group, like, for example, the liberal urban bourgeoisie. Rather, it was symptomatic, this interest in achievement was symptomatic for a broader trend towards achievement and achievement orientation that solidified across groups, especially across socioeconomic, gender, and religious categories. For various people, for people from different social strata with different backgrounds, their performance was and became more and more important for men as well as for women, for bourgeois people as well as for parts of the aristocracy, for white collar workers as well as for the working class. Furthermore, it would be wrong to describe this overarching trend as an expansion of bourgeois culture and lifestyle, as it has been done very often before. For the bourgeoisie, as I also make clear in my work, long cultivated a culture and lifestyle that indeed valued work and education. But these two were not cultivated as elements of performance. Rather, they were supposed to have an intrinsic value. In fact, the performance orientation that Jörg Simmel described, who rigorously advocated hierarchizing people according to their performance and only according to their performance, was quite alien to large parts of the bourgeoisie at that time. In my way, therefore, instead of assuming that people had all taken over a bourgeois lifestyle, in order to understand why achievement orientation was a broad phenomenon in Germany around 1900, it is more illuminating to understand the phenomenon in a praxeological perspective. In my work, I ask, coming from the field of historical anthropology, I ask what practices existed in everyday life that convinced people to believe in the value of achievement and in the hierarchization of people along that achievement. I ask what practices existed in everyday life that made something like a personal achievement plausible. And I should mention that I myself do not find it that plausible. I find it rather interesting that people thought of their personal achievement. If one approaches the topic in this way, it becomes clear that in many areas of life in Pan-Asiatic Germany, practices had emerged. In part, they had emerged completely new. In part, they had only expanded. That described performance as an incredibly important thing and as an incredibly personal thing. I'm talking about different types of performance tests, for example, performance competitions and other methods that were supposed to measure and assess personal performance and that were new at that time. Not only people who work in occupational fields were confronted with new forms of performance measurement, for example, for factory work or in some salaried professions. The same was true for every pupil in Germany, everyone who attended school. Unlike older cohorts, boys and girls were not only confronted with grades and examinations, that goes back many centuries, but they were also confronted with a grade that expressed as a number, which was to be understood as a characteristic value on an interval scale, and that was treated as an objective representation of a pupil's performance, a performance that then could be compared to the performances of other pupils. Pupils that were not in the same classroom, that were not in the same school, that were not even in the same town. Apart from the field of work and apart from the educational system, the field of leisure also witnessed an increase of performance tests. Whoever could read the newspaper, and literacy had advanced greatly towards the end of the century, regularly came across descriptions of competitions in which people were measured along their performance. Some of these competitions were organized nationally or locally, but many were also international. In fact, the turn of the century was a heyday of performance competitions in all sorts of fields, from singing competitions to trade school competitions to sport competitions that claimed to seek out and praise the best in the world, as it was said back then. Some of these competitions have outlived their time, like, for example, the modern Olympic Games or the Nobel Prize. I don't have time here to point out the very different logic of each of these competitions, even though these differences are important. And I cannot show how exactly these practices shape mentalities. Instead, here I want to highlight what these practices and the cult of performance surrounding them had to do with global connections. One aspect has already been mentioned. Some of the instruments to measure performance were regarded as instruments in order to hierarchize people across national borders on an international and sometimes even global level. That is certainly true for the modern Olympic Games as well as for the Nobel Prize, although it is very obvious too that in fact the people who attended in these kind of competitions mainly came from Europe. But the idea of the organizers was very much to find the best of the world. They wanted to compare achievements on a potentially global scale. And that's not the only link. The second link that I want to talk about is the increase of personal achievements. From a contemporary point of view, people's achievements seem to rise more and more. That was something that newspapers very often wrote about. How can it be that we get better and better all the time? Did people get better and better all the time? Well, it's true, at least if you accept the indicators used back then. for example, in a sports tournament or in a study on work performance. What was the reason for that rise? Now, there were a lot of different reasons, but one aspect was that the world was becoming more and more interconnected. In cycling races, to give just one example, not only were the riders better prepared towards the end of the century, let's say comparing the 1980s with the 1910s, but the bikes were better too. And this was true due to a certain material that was obtained in the global south, rubber, to start with. I give you a very different example. The fact that factory workers were able to deliver higher work performances was partly related to the improved standard of living too. And these growing living standards had a lot to do with the growing prosperity of Western industrialized nations as a whole. It had something to do with the emergence of the so-called welfare state, but it also had something to do with the growing economic wealth of Western nation states, including Germany. Although seen from the 19th century perspective, it's kind of problematic to call it a Western state. Let's say European state. My point is that the astounding performances given in some of these performance tests were in parts also delivered due to the effects of a world that was more and more interconnected and in which the economic profits were distributed unequally. Of course, perhaps I should have reserved more time to go into detail here, but if you have questions, we can do that in the discussion. At the same time, and this is my third and last point, practices to measure performance distracted from the collective and tentatively global quality of performances. What do I mean with that? Of course, the fact that the world was interconnected was not a secret back then. In fact, newspapers spoke a lot about Germany as a Weltmacht, as well as about Welthandel. And as I already mentioned, Simmel spoke a lot about the world too. Nevertheless, the quality of global networking and connections was only grasped one-sidedly. As Sebastian Konrad has shown in the already mentioned study, the construct of the nation allowed to neglect the dependencies of a globally interconnected world in decisive points. And analogously, I think the social practice of performance competitions and of practices that were supposed to measure personal performance allowed to ignore the interconnectedness of individuals. For at least tentatively, these practices showed individual people as supposedly autonomous actors who had to prove themselves with their skills and efforts only. In doing so, these practices detached actors from the social environment that surrounded them and that helped them to strive. No one actually achieved something alone. Everyone needed support, and everyone, to a certain extent, got support. Let it be, going back to Simmel's Berlin, the public transportation system in order to reach a tournament, or a wife in order to help with the translation of a foreign text. The social network that allowed people to strive had many different layers. It was constructed locally, think of the wife. It was constructed on the national level, think of the beginning of the so-called welfare state, and it was constructed globally. Practices that were supposed to measure personal achievements, even though they function in very different ways, if you look at them, if you look at each of them, all had in common that they kind of shifted the attention away from these social networks that helped people to strive. And these social networks, at least in parts at that time, had already a global dimension. So what I want to say is that these practices kind of shifted away the attention from potentially global networks that helped people to strive within Germany around 1900. Let me go back once more to Georg Simmel. The famous scholar of turn of the century Berlin did not contour a crude essentialist understanding of the man and his performance. Instead, Simmel quite significantly deconstructed the notion of the autonomous actor by thinking of the individual very much as a product of the networks in which it moved. But even Simmel did not maintain this focus on the social and relational quite consistently. In fact, when Simmel dealt with the performance of a person, usually a man, this person following Simmel acts in front of an audience, i.e. in front of others, it acts for others, and it acts along with others. But Simmel did not really talk about the division of labor. And he did not really talk about work that was done together. That was something that he neglected. And I think that is crucial because that's what these practices that I've talked about neglected too. To sum up very briefly, Simmel's sociology delivers a relational perspective on personal achievements. This perspective resonated with new practices in everyday life that were supposed to measure personal performance / achievement / lifestyle. These new practices blossomed in a time in which global connection blossomed too. And I do not think that there's a direct causal link between the two tendencies, but I do think that the one kind of helped to cover up the other. Practices to measure performance on the one hand were based on global connections. Sometimes they were supposed to have a global scope. Also, in some cases, people delivered astounding achievements due to the fact that they kind of could rely on a globally connected world. And at the same time, these practices shifted the attention away from the social conditions that everyone needs in order to achieve something. And with that, they shifted the attention away from the globe. Thank you very much for the attention.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.